Chapter 15.
Dell had definitely harbored reservations about the going undercover aspect of the mission, but he found it easier than he had anticipated. He'd always communicated better with his hands than with words, and once they'd cleared the cover story hurdle and Staven had agreed to let Pia Cow show him a few things, it got much easier. He'd never met a Chadra fan before. Although he had grown up on Coruscant, which was home to many species, he hadn't really interacted with many non-humans, certainly not once he was part of the Imperial War Machine. It took a little while for his ear to get accustomed to Pia Cow's high voice, but once it did, he felt right at home. In a way, even more than he did with his fellow squad members. Because Pia Cow's first language wasn't chittering and cheeping, it was mechanics. Just like Dell's. Under the Chadra fan's watchful eye, Dell had been entrusted with the repair of certain vessels. So far, they were minor issues, mostly maintenance. Pia Cow promised him that soon they would start repair work on what he called a very sad starfighter. Everything had emotional resonance for the Chadra fan, who had an insatiable curiosity and loved to tinker. Nothing, not an eating implement, not a bolt or screw or metal scrap or brightly colored stone, was overlooked. How he managed to find half of the things he collected was a mystery. And it was nothing short of unbelievable to watch him diligently turn these found bits and pieces into emergency replacements for certain items, new inventions, and sometimes just some kind of gizmo that whirred, blinked, and moved and did nothing but amuse. And then he turned to Dell and grinned, his lips pulling back from sharp little teeth. When he wasn't being supervised, Dell turned all his attention to the droid and the comlink. He'd sent the droid out for various things several times already. An extra bottle of water, or a tool, or a piece of fruit. The dreamers had gotten accustomed to it wandering around, humming a little to itself. Very soon, they'd cease to notice it as it went about its duties. Iden, of course, was the leader, and should be the first person Dell sent the droid to once he'd accomplished his goal. But Sen was the one who appeared to be the most accepted, and therefore the most likely to be permitted some solitude. Besides, she had given him some nonverbal cues that made him feel she had discovered something significant. Iden would just have to understand. Sen had been the one to advise against wearing communication devices of any sort, no matter how cutting-edge or cleverly disguised.
If this group has access to the sort of information we think they do, they may be aware of the latest technology, she had said. They'll be alert, at least at first, until they trust us.
Now Sen was kicking herself. She had learned something very important and very disturbing when Iden had arrived on Geosyn, and over the last couple of days she had tried and failed to find a way to speak with Inferno Squad's leader. Iden and the rest of the team needed to know what their intel specialist had discovered. Sen had been the first to arrive. She'd been questioned, of course, as Dell and Gideon had been when they arrived. Iden was being interrogated and examined, too, but the deep suspicion with which the Inferno Squad leader had been viewed troubled Sen. Iden was enduring much more scrutiny than Sen had expected, and she wondered if Staven had already made up his mind about the Admiral's daughter. She'd been relieved when the mentor had said something to Iden, and the two had left together earlier. Someone, at least, was reaching out to Sen's commanding officer. Sen had noticed that while the mentor often went on jaunts by himself, either on foot or in a small shuttle, he was never included in any off-world missions. She wondered why. He was trusted, obviously, and seemed to be liked by most of the dreamers, though sometimes Staven seemed exasperated by him. She had never seen the mentor before, she was sure of that. With her memory, to see once was to remember forever. He puzzled her. Sen knew she herself had been lucky. Dana had taken her under her wing from the outset, and now the Twi'lek was the main partisan who worked with Sen. She'd passed all their tests with flying colors, demonstrating a believable level of familiarity with computers and forgery, and turning out high-quality faked documents. They still weren't ready to explain what the forgeries would be used for,
When asked if she knew how to pilot a vessel, she claimed ignorance. But she did ask if they would teach her to shoot. She explained that with her steady hand and sharp eyes, she might be good at it. Staven had said he'd think about it. It was a skeleton crew at the moment, as most of the Dreamers were currently off-world. Del was off tinkering with Piakow, and Staven and Gideon were heating rations and discussing piloting when Sen entered the main cavern, or, more precisely, arguing about piloting. "When are you going to let me show you what I can do?" Gideon was saying. "All in good time." "You're paranoid," Gideon said. He looked thoroughly exasperated, and Sen knew him well enough to know it wasn't entirely a performance. Gideon loved flying, and he was starting to push for more than the blue milk runs that Del had referred to. Somewhat to Sen's surprise, the tactic seemed to be working. "Saw taught me how to be paranoid," was Staven's reply. "It's kept us alive." "Yeah, well, it's keeping me grounded, and you're wasting a valuable resource." Staven smiled, almost indulgently. "I'll tell you what, when the others get back, I'll take you up on it. You can show me what you can do." Gideon pressed a hand to his heart. "Don't toy with me, Staven," he said, and both men laughed. They smiled a greeting at Sen as she entered and helped herself to some fruit, milk, and hard-boiled Preva eggs. "Sen," Staven said, rising. "Just the person I wanted to see. I got another job for you." He motioned her over and she obliged. "It's pretty simple compared to some of the others we've asked you to do. Identification cards for students at a small university." He handed it to her. The image of a young human male about Sidori's age stared back at her. Sen wondered how they had obtained the card, and if they had eliminated its owner. "Acceptable casualties," she reminded herself. She examined the card, thinking. "That doesn't look too difficult," she said. In reality, it would be almost pathetically easy. This obviously wasn't a military school which eliminated all kinds of challenges.
"For Sidori?"
Staven gave her an odd smile. "We'll need two, actually. One for Sidori and one for you, if we decide you're ready when the time comes." She was genuinely surprised and pleased.
"Me?"
she said, allowing the emotions to charge the word.
"Thank you."
"Don't thank me," Staven said. "Thank Sidori."
Sen ducked her head in a gesture of shyness. Sidori hadn't yet said anything to her other than the occasional greeting. This was an excellent development on many levels.
"I'll thank him as soon as he gets back. Do you think I'll be ready?"
"You'd better be," Staven said. "You two are the only ones the right age. Even Kaeve's too old for this, but don't worry. We got time yet to train you."
"Is it all right if I take my breakfast back with me?" she asked. "I'm anxious to get started on this."
Staven hesitated, then seemed to reach a decision about her.
"Sure, why not?" he said. "Just don't get any yolk on the document."
She laughed and left with her food, the ID card, and a lighter heart. When she entered the sleeping area, she was surprised to find someone, or rather something, waiting for her. It was Del's droid. Sen glanced around to make sure she was alone, then put the food down, turned to the droid, and pressed a button on the hovering machine. A small hologram of Del appeared.
"Give your comlink to the droid. When it gives it back to you, press the second button and say my name."
The hologram vanished.
"Second?"
Sen thought, confused. The comlinks used by the Dreamers had only one. Shrugging, she handed it over to the ID-10. It immediately went to work on the device, its limbs moving so quickly and deftly they were almost a blur. Once, it even produced a tiny chip. After a few moments, it booped to signal completion and handed the comlink back. It now had two buttons on it. Sen clicked the second one very carefully.
"Del?"
she said.
"It worked!"
Del's voice was relieved and delighted.
"But from now on, we need to be careful. Always start by using the name of the person you're calming, and if it's safe, they'll say clear. If not, just pretend you're reaching out for some other Dreamer-approved reason."
"Copy that. What did you do?"
"Essentially, you're now holding two comlinks. One that everyone can access, and one that only the four of us can.
You're a genius, Sen said.
Well, best of the best, right? I'm going to have the droid hook us all up as soon as I can.
Her pleasure faded.
Listen up. Before anyone walks in on me, there's something I have to tell you.
Chapter 16.
Gideon had spent the last few days doing his best to sell himself and his piloting skills to Staven. He had tentatively probed for information as to how much, or preferably how little, the Dreamers knew about the other cells. Staven had said that no one had mentioned the brothers, but Sidori had helpfully chimed in that people often drifted in and out, so it looked like the brothers Farron were safe from discovery, at least for the moment. He hoped the hostility that was being shown to Aiden would ease up. It was understandable, of course, and not unexpected, but if they continued to keep her at arm's length, Inferno Squad's job would be far more difficult. Even as he thought of Aiden, she and the mentor entered the cave. They were talking very intently, their heads close together. Aiden met Gideon's eyes and nodded a greeting. They went for one of the food alcoves, unpacking pieces of fruit as they continued their conversation. Gideon turned back to Staven and noticed that the other man was still watching the retreating figure of Sen. There was softening on a face prematurely hardened.
Rough life that one's had,
Gideon ventured.
No one's had it easy,
Staven replied.
No, but she's got it harder than most. She seems to be coming out of her shell.
Yeah, I'm glad. She reminds me of someone. Gideon wagged his eyebrows.
Oh, really? Does Nadrine know?
No, not like that. This kid. She was presented as Saw's adopted daughter, but, well, she was very good at forging things. A little younger than Sen is now. Similar name, even. I'm glad Dana brought Sen back with her. Staven had struck Gideon as being one of those very tough, angry young men who always seemed to pop up when rebellion was in the air. He was reminded that many such young men, even partisans, were terribly idealistic. It was sad, really, but it was something that Inferno Squad could use.
What happened to the other girl?
Gideon inquired. It was the wrong question. The softness hardened again. Dead, he said. In the end, everyone's dead. Some just sooner than others. He rose abruptly and went out. The mentor and Aiden fell silent as he passed them, without even an inquiry about what they'd been doing. The silence was awkward. Finally, the mentor spoke.
Staven is hard because he's been hurt, the mentor said. He's lost a lot of people he loved. The only way you can get through that is if you really believe they died making a difference.
The destruction of the Death Star came at a pivotal moment for the Rebellion, and at a not inconsiderable cost. But I truly believe that the Rebellion will succeed.
We'll see if you're right, old man.
The mentor sighed.
I suppose I am, to you two. I do feel old sometimes, when I think back on all I've witnessed. But I have faith.
Regardless, even if it fails, tyranny cannot stand forever. It is an ugly beast that must feed. Eventually, the Empire will devour everything it has and will turn on its own.
Have you lost people you've loved?
There was a twinkle of a much younger man in the mentor's eye as he replied wryly,
I'm old, remember?
More seriously, he added,
Yes, of course I have. My parents were killed back during the Clone Wars, and my goddaughter was killed too. She was a partisan.
He nodded in the direction of Staven.
He loved her.
That took Gideon by surprise. He wanted to ask more, but he heard voices outside and realized that one of the ships had returned. The mentor smiled.
You'd better get out there and hold Staven's feet to the fire before he puts you off again.
The moment had passed. It was unfortunate, but the old man had a point. And Gideon was anxious to be flying again.
You're right about that, Gideon said to him.
nodded at Aiden, and went out to greet the returning dreamers. The Vushan family, Kaeve and Nadreen, were obviously in high spirits. Nadreen's face lit up when she saw Staven, and she quickened her pace. So did he, and he pulled her to him for a deep kiss. Gideon believed the mentor when he said Staven had loved his goddaughter. But it was also clear that the dreamer leader cared deeply for the freckled girl with the laughing eyes. If anything were to happen to her, it would certainly affect him and possibly destabilize the group. Gideon gave the Kagis and Azin his friendliest smile. How'd it go? He didn't expect to hear him any details. It was just another supply run. So he was surprised when Halia said, "We brought back a present for you, Staven."
"For me? You shouldn't have," Staven said. "I've had my eye on the latest blaster model."
"Better than that," came Azin's voice. "We brought back a hero." Aiden and the mentor were talking about how to project without losing one's voice as Gideon entered. "Speak from here," the mentor said, placing a hand on his mid-belly, "from the diaphragm."
"Aiden."
Gideon's voice sounded off. She turned to look at him, but his expression was unreadable.
"Staven wants you."
"I'm coming," she said, but she didn't need to. The Vushans, Azin, and Staven entered the main gathering cavern, and they had someone with them. The stormtrooper had lost his helmet and the rest of his upper body armor at some point. His face had been beaten and bloodied, and the black body glove he wore beneath his uniform was torn. Azin hauled him in by one of his arms. The other dangled limply at an angle that ought to have been impossible. Aiden's breath caught, but she forced herself to appear calm.
"Mentor," Staven said, "how did your first session go with our budding new star?"
"What?"
asked the mentor, astonished. It seemed like the strangest query, with a bleeding half-conscious stormtrooper not 3 meters away. "Let's have Aiden do a first audition," Staven said. "Sidori, get a holo recorder."
While the youngest Kagi raced off to obey, Azin threw the trooper to the stone floor of the cave. He cried out and laid there panting. His uninjured arm quivered as he tried to push himself up.
"This man fancied himself a hero of the Empire. Tried to stop us stealing supplies in an old storage area no one cares about. So we'll feature him in your first speech."
Aiden stared, appalled. This man had only been doing his duty. He'd been harming no one, and he was far from any position of power.
"Anyone can beat up a guard," she said, grasping for something, anything, to prevent this from happening. "This won't look good. We'll just look like bullies." "I want to see what you can do."
His voice was jovial, but his eyes were cold.
"Staven, this is foolish," the mentor said. "Aiden's right. We won't inspire anyone if we record this."
Sidori returned to the cavern carrying the requested holoprojector. Staven placed it down and turned it on.
"Go ahead, Aiden," he said. "Let's hear what kind of a voice of the dreamers you are."
She couldn't, but she had to try. Had to do something, or else she'd be on the floor, beaten, bloodied, and broken, just like the unlucky stormtrooper was. "So, stiff-legged, Aiden Versio, TIE fighter pilot, Death Star survivor, daughter of Admiral Garrick Versio, went to the sprawled figure on the ground and stood over him, her hands on her hips. But she couldn't think of what to say. Couldn't come up with the phrases of hatred and justification that Staven wanted. The stormtrooper unwittingly saved her. As Aiden frantically tried to speak, he coughed, violently spewing up blood, twitched, and lay still.
"That was uncalled for, Staven," the mentor said quietly.
"I think it would have sent a powerful message,"
Staven said.
"Oh, I'm not disagreeing with you on that. It would just have been the wrong message."
Staven glared angrily at the mentor for a moment. Then his gaze slid over to Aiden.
"We'll never know now. I'm not sure our voice was up to the task."
"Don't worry about me," Aiden snapped.
"But I do, you see, and that's the problem."
He shook his head, the anger visibly draining from him to be replaced by a look of exhaustion.
I either need a drink or a flight.
Well, Gideon said, how about you let me show you what I can do flying, and then you can show me what you can do drinking.
Aiden continued to stay silent, but was profoundly grateful for the distraction Gideon was offering. She had no desire to be around Staven right now. In fact, she had no desire to be around anyone. She needed to run to clear her head to erase the image of what had just happened. Even though she knew that this was likely just the beginning of what she would be asked to do in the name of the Dreamers. Asked to do for the Empire, she reminded herself.
You know what? Staven said. Let's do it. Put on something you want to fly in and let's head to the scrap heap. Then show me what you got.
The what?
You'll see, Staven said. And calm Del. I want to take his droid along, too. I'll meet you at the ship.
What about him? Gideon asked, gesturing to the body on the floor. Dana and Sen had wandered in, drawn by the commotion. And Sen was now talking in hushed tones with Sidori and Halia. Two Inferno Squad team members did not make eye contact.
Rue, Aizen, take him out to the usual spot.
Aiden felt her stomach clench at the words and their significance.
Gideon had rejoined Staven wearing the outfit in which he'd arrived, complete with the battered brown jacket. Aiden had suggested he wear it frequently, to further cement his connection to the now-extinct cell in the Dreamer's mind. It was the same outfit he had worn at Telic 4, and, as Sen had thought he might, Staven had indeed seen the altered footage of the explosion at Singularity.
"I thought they outfitted pilots better at Nebula," he said, referring to Gideon's alleged old partisan cell.
"Hey, if you have something better, I'd gladly wear it," Gideon replied. He thought it was a pretty good sidestep. He was starting to get used to this whole undercover thing.
"We'll find out if you're worth wasting a flight suit on," Staven retorted. "Let's go, flyboy."
The scrap heap to which Staven was referring was a cache of stolen ships housed in another one of the seemingly ubiquitous caverns that riddled the landscape. It indeed looked like a large-scale junkyard. Everything from land speeders to droid parts to starfighters was here. Staven had brought a light and led Gideon past ship after ship, taking him deeper into the cavern's sloping chamber. Gideon unfastened the droid from his back, casually thumbed a concealed button, and let it explore. It would record everything it saw, and that could be very useful at some point. Del had hoped that once the Dreamers dropped their guard, the droid could be utilized for eavesdropping. But for now, it wasn't yet welcome everywhere. As they moved back, the droid emitted a few noises of discovery. They sounded sad to Gideon's ears, but that was probably him anthropomorphizing. It was just a machine. He turned, curious, and his eyes widened as his gaze fell on the damaged TIE fighter. He felt like he'd been kicked in the chest and stared too long at it, drawing Staven's attention. If the droid had indeed felt sad, Gideon certainly shared the emotion.
Yep,
Staven said, stepping beside him and gazing at the black vessel.
We managed to steal one of those and bring it back. Somewhat the worse for wear, unfortunately. Ever seen one of these babies up close before?
Gideon shook his head.
Nope, he said, glad his voice didn't betray him.
The Empire makes good ships, I'll give him that. I want to get it fixed up one day and use it against the bastards. I guess everyone has a dream, right?
A cold, slow anger began to simmer inside Gideon, along with the urge to strike the rebel leader.
Right, he said instead. Maybe you should get Del on that.
Right now, said Staven, I'm getting you in that.
Gideon tore his eyes away from the TIE to see what Staven was pointing to, and did a double take. It was a very beat-up, very sad-looking A-wing.
You're kidding me. I never kid. That piece of junk would make Del cry. Hell, it would make his droid cry.
He put his hands on his hips and sighed.
Well, takes a sense of humor to ask me to fly that. Or have you lost that completely?
Strangely, Staven smiled. I had one once. We win this war, I might have it again. But for now, let's just say, if you can put this old rattletrap through its paces and make it look good, you pass.
Gideon almost started laughing as the droid moved from one end of the ship to the other, conducting a cursory inspection. It was almost more than his life was worth to even get in the thing, let alone do acrobatics with it. But then again, his life was indeed on the line. At last, the droid came back.
Is it flyable? Gideon asked it.
The droid beeped. Dell was better than anyone at deciphering its sounds, but after several days alone with it and Dell in the close quarters of the fast friend, he'd come to understand it pretty well. The droid was giving him the equivalent of, "I think this might be safe." Hopefully, it would be better inside. It was not better inside.
What do we even use this for, anyway?
He asked Staven. The vessel had two seats, one for the pilot, one for an instructor. Staven settled down in the instructor's seat.
Target practice,
Staven replied, fastening his crash webbing.
That's not even funny,
Gideon said, taking time to familiarize himself with the controls. He'd never been in one of these before, and did not want to make any rookie mistakes.
I'm not joking,
Staven said. He kept his face straight for about 10 full seconds. Before a sly grin got the better of him.
Your face, he said, chuckling. But seriously, the A-Wing's spaceworthy, and if it turns out not to be, he patted the chair, both of these are ejectors.
The droid, hovering behind Gideon, suddenly booped and attached itself firmly to Gideon's shoulder.
Listen,
Gideon warned as he slowly moved the ship toward the cave entrance.
If you want me to show you what I can do, I'm going to put this ship through its paces. It might rattle your teeth a bit. You sure you can handle that kind of treatment?
Bring it on, said Staven.
Your funeral, said Gideon. Well, mine too, but I'm game.
As soon as they were cleared, he narrowed his eyes, his heart speeding up in gleeful anticipation.
Here we go, he said,
and the ship exploded into action. Staven swore loudly as he was slammed against the back of the seat. With barely a meter of clearance, Gideon maneuvered the ship like he would a speeder, zipping along the flat stone, then veering hard to the right to plunge into the overhanging canopy.
What the hell?
Staven said, turning to stare at Gideon with wide eyes. Gideon ignored him.
This is what you do to shake pursuit, he said.
He could hear the thumping and scraping of tree limbs against the ship's hull. But he'd assessed it well. There was enough space here for him to bring the ship through with little to no damage. It cleared out up ahead. He tilted the nose up sharply. Again, he and the partisan leader were flattened against the backs of their seats. He could feel the little droid tightening its grip, could hear its soft, long beeps. Up they soared, almost completely vertically. Then Gideon leveled it out. Time for some impressive moves. He pulled backward, and the A-Wing made a tight loop. And two more for good measure. Staven had fallen silent, and Gideon was grinning like an idiot. This was a rickety old bucket, and it might yet kill him. But if it did, he'd die doing what he loved. Back down again. He'd found the weapons controls now, and fire the laser cannons at that rock formation there, that clump of trees there. Then soared up and over the butte that was suddenly right in front of them. Up, up, piercing the cloud layer into a sky dotted with stars against a still purple field of frozen dusk. There was silence. Gideon turned to look at Staven. The leader of the dreamers looked more alive, more fully present than Gideon had yet seen him. Gone was the stone-faced, humorless man who had stared coolly at him and Dell, who had given Iden a look of almost pure hatred. That armor had been falling off him piece by piece as he welcomed his partner? Girlfriend? Back. More had been shed, as he had shown Gideon a place that the former TIE pilot believed Staven thought of less as a junkyard, and more as a treasure trove. Now, It was as if the armor were completely gone. This was Staven as he might once have been.
I've never seen anything like that in my life, the dreamer said, and I've seen a lot.
Pride surged in Gideon. Then it abated almost at once. Even at his best, Aiden had always been able to fly rings around him. And once Staven had seen Aiden fly, Gideon would again be relegated to second best in someone's opinion. The thought cooled his excitement, but he didn't erase it entirely. For now, Aiden was persona non grata, and Staven was impressed with him, and he would content himself with that. Shall we head back? He asked.
Not just yet, Staven said.
I think you still have a few more boulders to strafe.
Chapter 17.
Aiden forced herself to watch as Aizen and Rue stepped forward, picking up the stormtrooper's body between them and half-carrying, half-dragging him out of the cave. She wondered if anyone was going to clean up the blood and vomit. Even as she had the thought, Kaeve and Nadrine entered with buckets of water and cloths. Aiden couldn't help it. She looked away. The mentor sat with her for a moment longer, then excused himself.
I'll be in the sleeping cavern if you want to talk, Aiden. Or practice some more.
Sure looks like I need it, Aiden said. What Staven had done had been intended to shock her, to catch her off guard, and she was angry with herself that she had let the ploy work.
You'll be fine. I have absolute faith in you.
He patted her shoulder comfortingly, then rose and left. Dana, leaning against the cave entrance, watched him go, then turned to look at Aiden. She seemed to make up her mind about something and strode forward, sitting on the flattened rock beside the Admiral's daughter.
Bet you miss the feel of a blaster in your hand, Dana said.
Aiden looked at her in surprise. You read my mind, she said. Dana chuckled warmly.
No need for that. Our ways take some getting used to, and to be honest, that was a dirty trick Staven pulled on you.
Thanks, Aiden said uncertainly. But it sounds like this has happened before, if you have a usual place to put bodies.
It has, the Twi'lek said. We have scavengers here. Big ones. We call them crunchers. They're like big rodents, and I mean big. And they'll eat anything and all of it. They'll take off what we can use of the stormtrooper's armor and leave the rest for the crunchers.
Which meant that the armor Aiden would next be mending and cleaning would be the trooper's. Everything about this was ghoulish. She couldn't think of anything to say to that. Dana smiled kindly.
I know this is hard for you. These people used to be allies, but they aren't, and I believe you understand that. You'll get used to it, but until the Empire is overthrown, it has to be done.
Come on, let's go shoot something. A quick ride in a speeder took them to an open area with scattered boulders and the occasional lone tree. Some of the boulders, obviously, had been part of much larger ones at one time, and the black scoring on them told Aiden that this was a popular site for target practice. Aiden took the blaster that Dana handed her. It was an older model, but well-maintained, and it could kill just as efficiently as a newer one. You're letting me shoot. Thanks, Aiden said. Both women knew that there was a chance Aiden would simply use the blaster on Dana, and Aiden appreciated the trust. Now I just need to get Staven to let me pilot.
You sound like Gid, Dana said, casually flipping off the safety on her own blaster. Never saw a young man so in love with the sky. Staven's taken quite a shine to him.
Aiden was pleased that Staven had finally agreed to test Gideon's piloting skills. While she was better than her friend, she knew Gideon was superb. They were TIE fighter pilots. They had to be. She knew Gideon must miss being at the controls as much as she did, and she was glad he was getting the chance to fly again.
Watch my pattern and duplicate it, Dana said.
Casually, her blaster on minimum power so as not to reduce her target to rubble, the Twi'lek took aim and fired 7 times in what seemed like a random pattern. even whirling around after the fourth blast to shoot at boulders that were behind them. Iden watched like a sure hawk. It felt good to drop into that place of laser-like focus, to not think about a stormtrooper being beaten to death for protecting a warehouse or gigantic rat-like creatures devouring his remains, to not worry about letting some damning truth slip accidentally. She liked her world when it was just target, weapon, and her.
"Your turn,"
Dana said, bringing Iden back into the present, where every word was a potential grenade. Iden nodded. "Good for Gid," she said, as she aimed her blaster. "After this last fiasco, I'm beginning to think the only way I can get on Staven's good side is to single-handedly take down the Emperor." She emulated Dana, hitting the boulders in the precise order demonstrated.
"Good shooting,"
Dana said. The words casual, although the Twi'lek was clearly impressed.
"I think if you did get a shot at the Emperor, you just might be able to take him down. And don't be too hard on Staven. He'll come around. Now, see that cluster of trees?"
Iden saw some burned trunks that were on their last legs, or maybe their last roots. "If you want to call them that, yes," she replied. These were much further off, and Dana switched out her handheld blaster for a rifle. "There's 7 of them total. Some of them are harder to see than others. Again, memorize my order." Dana fired, then handed over the rifle. And again, Iden completed the exercise perfectly. Unlike Sen or Del or even Gideon, she didn't have to pretend to be less experienced than she actually was. The Dreamers knew her reputation, and now all that skill and training was on their side. Or so they thought. She and Dana had turned one of the trees into nothing more than kindling by the time they were done. "How long have you been with the Dreamers?" Iden asked. She figured she had plenty of time to ask innocent-sounding questions and, hopefully, get a lead on which Dreamer was the one with the intel. And while it wasn't flying, it felt glorious to be shooting a weapon again.
"The whole group is new,"
Dana said. She holstered her blaster and began walking, waving for Iden to follow her. They were heading toward another cluster of boulders.
"We were bits and pieces of other groups. After Saw's death, we kind of crumpled. Some went off on solo missions that were really just suicide by Stormtrooper. Others disappeared, maybe turning themselves in.
Like Bok," Iden thought, but did not say.
"Staven and the Mentor connected somehow.
They won't even tell us.
They're a strange pair, but they loved Saw, and they love Liberty, and they hate the Empire. Staven's the boss, but he values the Mentor. We're doing things now that the old partisans could never do. And I am so glad to be a part of it."
She glanced over at Iden.
"And I'm glad you're here too, Iden. To see someone who was once so deep in the Empire's heart, and know she understands, you're going to inspire a lot of people. And you'll make a difference. But first, we're going to try to shoot each other."
Iden's body grew taut. Then Dana laughed.
"I was joking," she said. "I just want to test your reflexes. We're going to use these boulders for cover and fire at each other. First one to get stunned loses. And," she added, "do make sure your blaster isn't on kill."
When she and the Twi'lek returned about an hour later, the bloodstains on the stone cavern floor were gone. Staven and Gideon had returned, and the Dreamer leader looked much more relaxed. He even nodded politely to Iden as she entered.
"Your codes," he said. "We're going to try them next trip."
Iden blinked in surprise. "Great. I hope they haven't changed. It's been 4 days. Staven scowled.
"Yeah, that one's on me."
Gideon was indeed being a good influence. That was as close to an apology as Iden thought she'd ever get from the blue-haired young man.
"Some of us are going on a supply run later this afternoon. You're welcome to come if you like,"
Dana said, as Iden reached for a bottle and filled it from a water container.
"We're going over to the sun side. Might be a nice change for you."
Iden was about to open her mouth to agree when Dell's droid, which had been hovering beside Gideon, turned its red photoreceptor in her direction. Slowly, it blinked 3 times as it looked directly at her. Dell's words came back to her.
I'm trying to make sure this little guy can help out in all kinds of ways.
Thanks for the invitation, Dana, but I think I'll try to find the mentor. Anyone know where he is? If he was on site, she'd talk to him briefly, then go for a run and get somewhere safe to talk to Dell through the droid. If not, she could go look for the mentor.
He went off a while ago,
Kaeve said, as he entered and headed straight for the food alcove.
He does that a lot.
Never sure where he goes, just says that he has to go sort out his thoughts. Convenient. Staven, you're right. I need more practice. He looked as surprised at her words as she doubtless had earlier. Then he nodded. Good, was all he said. The droid floated out of the cavern.
And off it goes back to Dell, Gideon said. I'm jealous of him and that little contraption. He needs to make me one.
He needs to make all of us one, Iden said, then left. Sen was in the common sleeping cavern and looked up when Iden entered.
Are you all right?
Sen asked quietly.
Are you?
Iden replied.
Staven likes to shock. We should expect things like this from now on.
As Sen spoke, the droid entered, humming.
Oh, good. Finally. Give your comm link to the droid. Dell has installed a second button for a second channel for us.
She filled Iden in on the security around this method of communication while the droid went to work. Iden clicked the second button and, as instructed, said, Dell?
Clear?
Dell's warm voice replied, and the two women exchanged relieved glances.
You're brilliant, Dell, Iden said.
Remember you said that when we finally get debriefed. The three of us have been in communication for a while via this channel. Gid's still with Staven, but since no one questions our talking privately together, I can catch him up later. Captain, I know you have things to share with us, but I think Sen's got the most pressing concern.
Curious, Iden looked at Sen. With the somberness that belied her young features, Sen stated,
I recognized Azen Novarin. He's an Imperial agent. His real name is Lar Kentayan.
Stunned, Iden managed. Did he recognize you too?
We've never met or worked together. I'm lucky that at one point his file crossed my desk and I took a brief look at it. I wish I'd seen more, but I can tell you what I know.
Iden was profoundly grateful for Sen's eidetic memory as the former Nav-Int agent continued.
He was a less-than-stellar ISB agent. He had a couple of formal censures, and there was talk of termination.
She didn't elaborate as to what kind of termination had been discussed.
You will recall your father said that there had been an attempt to infiltrate the Partisans before? That was Lar Kentayan. Though I guess we should call him Azen Novarin now. He and Staven have worked together before, but Novarin was acting as our agent. ISB recalled him, which is why he and Staven hadn't seen each other in a couple of years. Novarin was reassigned to Vardos.
Vardos? Iden asked, why Vardos?
It was definitely a demotion. The Empire always likes to keep an eye on things, and there were apparently rumors that Gleb might not be as trustworthy as one would like. Skimming off the top, making her own deals, that sort of thing. The document didn't go into specifics, and investigations like this happen all the time. However, because it was Vardos, Admiral Versio was not informed that she was under investigation.
Iden rubbed her eyes. One hand didn't know what the other hand was doing then. All right, so he was reassigned to Vardos, and my father didn't know. But why did Azen bring me here? Would they have reassigned him?
No, Sen said firmly. Not back to the Partisans with that kind of record.
So he's acting on his own.
In my opinion, yes. From what we've heard here, he and Staven were in contact while he was on Vardos. He knew Staven was looking for a mouthpiece, and then you appeared.
Is he acting as a partisan or as an Imperial agent? There was silence, from both Dell and Sen.
Let me rephrase that. Sen, what would be your best guess?
It's hard to tell. He wasn't pulled out because anyone felt he was becoming a true believer, but rather that he wasn't accomplishing anything. My best guess would be that he's either become a double agent, or he's trying to get back into ISB's good graces by handing them a real coup.
The last true leader of the Partisans, me, and whoever the mentor is, Aiden said.
The mentor?
It was Del.
What about him?
That can wait, but essentially, I have reason to believe that once he was a public figure of some note. I'll have plenty of one-on-one time with him to see what else I can get him to tell me. I do know that, like Staven, he worked with Saw early on and knew and respected Saw's sister, Stila.
Gid said that the mentor's goddaughter was involved with the Partisans and that Staven was in love with her,
Del offered. That's a pretty major connection, Aiden said. They seem so different, Staven and the mentor, on so many levels. Dana says that the two of them formed the Dreamers together. They've both got ties not to just Saw, but to each other. They're both determined to honor his memory by destroying the Empire. I had suspected that he or Staven would be our target, but now I have to wonder if our leak is Aizen. He's the only one we know for certain once had access to classified Imperial information.
I'd agree about Aizen, and I'm surprised to hear about the mentor. I didn't recognize him, Sen said.
She looked annoyed. Sen, you can't have seen pictures of everyone in the known galaxy, Aiden said. Don't worry about it. We'll figure all that out later. Right now, what I want to know is Aizen going to be a problem? Does he suspect us?
I think he would have let us know if he did, Sen said.
No wonder he searched me so carefully, Aiden said. He was trying to find out if I was acting on behalf of the Empire. That certainly would have thrown a wrench into the works. Good to know my cover passed an ISB agent's inspection. Del, any way you can set up a bug on him? There was a silence. Then he said,
I can try. But if the Partisans are paranoid and double-check everything, you can bet that a double agent would be worse. It'd be awfully risky. And if he found out about us?
We can't let that happen, Aiden interrupted. The thought of being at Aizen's mercy or revealing anything about what they were doing? No. Inferno Squad had a purpose far beyond one man's greed, and there was no way to tell where his loyalty really lay. If he had any at all. Damn it. This was the last thing we needed. We don't have time to play a long game against two enemies.
So what do we do?
Sen hesitated, then said,
My instincts say we can't trust him. The reason he was given black marks were, and I quote, Agent failed to provide sufficient support to fellow operatives. I think if he finds out about Inferno Squad's mission, he'd use us to get the intel for himself, then turn us over to Staven right away, even if he isn't a double agent. He won't want us stealing his thunder if or when he betrays the Dreamers.
If you were working with him in the field, would you trust him?
And if you were his superior, would you send him out in the field again?
No, to both. Not in a million years.
Del?
I don't have Sen's insight, but I certainly don't like him. Gideon says he'd like to punch him, but while that would be entertaining, I don't think it would help.
Aiden smiled a little. Del always knew what to say and when. I'm with you all. I hate to say this about a fellow Imperial, but I don't trust him. And we can't risk this mission.
What are your orders, Captain?
Del asked. Sen looked at Aiden expectantly. We have to find out if he's our leak, and recover what we were sent here to find, if so. Regardless, we take him down. And here's how we're gonna do it.
Chapter 18
Sen was impatient as she returned to the main cavern. It was a new sensation for her. Since her graduation from the academy, and even before, she had been capable of deep focus for extended periods of time. While she had heard some of the others complain about how much they disliked living in half-light all the time, Sen didn't mind this aspect of the mission. She had spent almost all of her time in a small room, alone with the comfortable glow of computer screens. Then her role had been passive,
a translator, an observer. But now, she was interacting, and in ways quite different from those she had anticipated. The subject of one of those ways was waiting for her, his strong, chiseled features drawn with worry. Sidori had noticed her reaction to the stormtrooper's murder, and they had talked about it a little bit, but he was still concerned about how she might be feeling. It was touching, and strange, and Sen was conflicted. If she was smaller and looked younger than her age, then Sidori was the opposite. Well-built and graceful, he looked older than Kaeve, who had 4 years on him. The Kagi, in general, were regarded as uncommonly beautiful among humans and near-humans, and Sidori was a fine example of that. How was it that this kind young man, who was so fierce when he fought, and so gentle when he did not, found it so easy to reconcile the level of violence that the dreamers advocated?
"Are you all right, Sen?"
he asked solicitously.
"Yes," she said. "I've had some time to think."
To remind herself of why she was there, and to have a new goal to focus on.
"Sometimes hard choices are necessary ones. Is this something you had to learn too?"
"My people are born into lives of deprivation," he said. "I knew how to fight almost before I knew how to walk."
The fighting ability of the Kagi warriors, it was said, sometimes evoked comparison to the Jedi. They were physically powerful and phenomenally agile.
"We fought together as a team. Well, forever."
"Does your family still go on missions together?"
Sen inquired. As she listened to the response, which could be valuable, she also listened to conversations going on in other tongues.
"Change the security code, it..."
"We used to. Until Saw's death. Now when I go on a mission, one of my parents always comes with me while one stays behind."
She looked at him, askance.
"I don't understand. Why don't they want to fight together anymore?"
He looked embarrassed.
"It's silly,"
he said.
"Excellent place for a drop and run,"
Rue, Sidori's father, was saying quietly to Aizen.
"If you were trained so young, you obviously know how to take care of yourself."
"It's not that. Since Jedha things..."
He hesitated.
"We're dedicated. All of the dreamers, not just my family. You've seen it. We all go in with bombs on our bodies and we're ready to use them, but I'm their only child. And if something went wrong, they want someone there to protect me, and someone back here if... And so there's one of them left for me to come back to."
Something inside Sen softened unexpectedly. It was such a strange juxtaposition. This calm discussion about bombs strapped on bodies and parents not wanting to leave a beloved child an orphan, even as their actions could make orphans of others. Impulsively, she reached out and squeezed his arm.
"Don't be ashamed of that," she said. "They love you. They know what we do is dangerous, and they want to minimize any risk you might have. I'm sure it's not because they don't respect you as a warrior."
His normally guarded face lit up with surprised pleasure. Then he gently placed his own large, strong hand over her small one.
"I think I finally understand how they might feel that way. I'm glad you're coming on a mission with me, but I wish you weren't, too,"
Sidori said.
"I wanted to ask you first, but I didn't think I should get your hopes up in case Davin said no. I thought it would be a good opportunity for you."
"Do you know the details?"
Sidori shook his head.
"Staven hasn't shared them yet. He likes to keep things close to his vest,"
Sen had noticed.
"You can say no if you want to."
"This is important," Sen said. "I want to be a part of it."
Gideon was holding forth about flying. Staven was laughing and had his arm around Nadrine, who snuggled into him with a soft, contented smile.
"It is important,"
Sidori agreed.
"Since Jedha, just like Staven said, there's been a fresh urgency. I'm glad we're in a unit with two people who actually knew Saw. I trust them to know what they're doing, how to make everything we do count. We need to strike and not hold back, no matter what the mission or the target. My family is fighting for something that's even more important than our homeworld. We're fighting for a future doesn't involve fighting,"
Sidori said. his voice soft. He gazed at her intently, and his hand on hers was warm.
If he'd just tell us more,
Rue continued.
There you are,
Aizen's voice. He was addressing Aiden and the mentor, who apparently had just returned. Sidori sighed, squeezed Sen's hand, and let go as they both turned to the newcomers.
Where have you two been? More rehearsals?
As many as it takes, Aiden said before the mentor could speak.
I'll help as much as I can,
the mentor promised her.
How about now? Aiden suggested.
I like how you think, exclaimed the mentor.
Let's go.
Sen watched them leave. Do you need to get back to work too? Sidori asked her.
Yes, Sen thought, I do. She knew Del needed information about Aizen in order to conduct an efficient search of the ship's data bank.
But there was other work to be done, too. She turned to Sidori and took his large, strong hand in hers, curling her fingers about his.
I'd rather sit here and talk, she said. The mentor seems so nice. How long have you known him?
Piakau had been resting, which had given Del the time he'd needed to upgrade Aiden's comlink and discuss Sen's discovery. After the conversation, Del took advantage of the fact that he had his droid, but not his minder, and went to the cavern where Aiden's old JSEC starfighter was being kept. His first thought had been to access the computer. Aiden had replied that, unfortunately, she would not be of help in this case. During her time under house arrest on Vardos, she had not been permitted to have access to the ship's computer for anything other than routine flights. Only her co-pilot, most recently one Aizen Novaran, also known by a host of other aliases, knew that. So Del had to rely on the droid. He kept one eye on the entrance to the cavern while the droid hummed and beeped as it attempted to bypass security protocols. Sen had offered to compile a list for Del of everything she knew about Aizen, so soon he would have a list of keywords to look for. They were all bringing their best game towards this abruptly urgent task, but Del never quite realized just how alone they would be if things didn't go according to plan. The mineral composition of the planet's rocks, which helped conceal the Dreamer's vessels and technology, also made any contact impossible unless it was local, or the communication equipment was out in the open. There was no way for Inferno Squad to contact the Admiral that wouldn't be detected. The hope was that soon at least one member of the team would be deemed trustworthy enough to fly solo. Then, whoever it was might possibly be able to get a message out. If the mission went well, that moment might arrive sooner rather than later. But it sure as hell wasn't now. Del simply had to hope they'd get lucky. Because if they didn't, it would only be a matter of time before a trained Imperial agent, double or not, would sniff them out. He had barely started when Piakau calmed him.
Come back to the cavern, he chirped. There's something I want to show you.
Frustrated, Del asked. Are you sure? I can keep working on my own if you want to rest some more.
I'm certain. And there's plenty of time to sleep when you're dead, so come on back.
Curious as to what this was all about, Del obeyed. Piakau had a sly, satisfied look on his bat-like face as he bustled Del into a speeder that he himself, naturally, had revamped to suit his small stature as driver.
Staven gave me this one in exchange for my promise to quit trying to, improve the others without express permission, he said, in all seriousness.
It looks terrific, Del said politely.
Actually, it looked slightly insane. Piakau had completely gutted the interior. The entire console had been redesigned with all the buttons and the steering wheel sized to the Chandrafan's smaller fingers and much shorter reach. They were also much prettier than standard utilitarian buttons and glowed like tiny gemstones. Piakau's seat was designed to accommodate his size and was luxuriously padded, and the crash webbing was decorative as well as efficient. The overall effect was that the small furred driver was snuggled in securely, wrapped almost like a baby in a blanket. It would have been funny, except that Piakau looked so pleased and content with the results.
Del didn't know what his friend had done with the ship's engine, but when he climbed in and Piakau took off, it was a startlingly smooth and swift ride.
"Where are we going?"
he asked as the speeder zipped along. "Did you know," said Piakau, answering with another question,
"that there used to be a sentient species on Geosyn?"
"I did not," Del admitted.
"Since I'm not able to go on any missions, I've spent my time here, learning about this world. These long dawns and twilights and the even longer days and nights, everything had to evolve to accommodate that. The animal life, for instance, nearly everything that's not rooted down either migrates or hibernates. And because the dawns and dusks are so long, there's a whole variety of species that live just in those windows. It's fascinating."
Del wasn't a scientist, but Piakau's enthusiasm was contagious. It was kind of interesting. He settled back in to listen.
"And the plants," Piakau crowed. "Incredible! They alternate between the sun and volcanic activity for their energy. There's so much to learn here. So many different examples of ways to think creatively. For instance, you already know that one of the reasons we're so safe here is that there's a unique combination of minerals in the planet's surface that prevents anyone from scanning us. Isn't that helpful? What could we do with that? If we had the resources to understand the combination..."
Del realized that Piakau had been squandered laboring in a factory. If someone in the Empire had reached out to him and his family and given him a place in research... But that was a dark road to go down, and a futile one. What was done, was done. He redirected Piakau back to the original topic. "Tell me about the sentient life," he said.
"Oh, right. Well, I can't."
Del blinked. "What?"
"Well, I can't because we've no idea what happened to them. I've read up on the archaeological expeditions, and they're all laced with extreme frustration. The most recent one happened over a century ago. Everyone washed their hands of this place because there's just not anything to explore. The species left no remains, no buildings, very few tools, no writing or art that's recognizable as such, and no technology. Except for one thing."
"What?" Piakau, who had been diligently keeping his eyes forward and his hands on the tiny wheel, now gave Del a devious glance.
"That's where we're going."
Del frowned. "Give me a hint." The Chadra fan, clearly delighted with Del's reaction, shook his large-eared head.
"Nope. You'll see."
Resigned, Del settled back into his seat and closed his eyes. And then the next thing he knew, Piakau was poking him with his clawed, stubby fingers and saying,
"We're here. Wake up."
Here seemed to be yet another cavern. Piakau climbed out of the speeder, retrieved his walking stick and lantern, and moved towards the yawning entrance. Del swung his long legs out and caught up quickly.
"I found what I'm about to show you quite by accident a few years ago,"
Piakau said, a bit sheepishly.
"When I first arrived, I'd built my little speeder and was doing some exploring of my own. Not the wisest idea, considering I fell and crashed through an extraordinarily thin layer of rock into a second cavern below. Fortunately, I was able to get out. In the meantime, I discovered something wonderful. Come on."
He ambled farther inside the cavern. Del followed, and then he stopped. "Is it my imagination, or is it getting lighter in here?"
"It is, or isn't. I mean, it's not your imagination. The light is coming from the hole I made when I fell through."
The two continued on, the light growing stronger, a cool indigo illumination. Del could see the aforementioned hole in the stone floor now, and a ladder poking up from it. Another lamp and various tools and a length of rope sat at the ready beside the mouth. Piakau went to the ladder and plunked down his lamp. Carefully, he began to descend, pausing only to wave Del forward.
Come on, come on.
Del didn't need much more urging. Other than pausing to ascertain whether the ladder would bear his weight, he followed willingly. Like darkness made visible, the indigo radiance wrapped around him as he descended. When his feet touched solid ground, Del turned around and started back, gasping. They were huge, and they were stone, and they were still. And they stretched back as far as the eye could see. They had heads and arms and legs, and the beautiful, eerie purple light was shining from what passed for eye sockets. Statues, he murmured. They're beautiful.
And a trifle alarming, Piakau said. I must confess, I was scared to death for a moment when I first saw them.
Del wasn't going to admit to having the same reaction. If the creations before him had been crafted to resemble their long-dead mysterious creators, the beings had been near human, though the faces, save for those eerie, radiant eye sockets, were a complete blank. The heads didn't even have hair, or a realistic shape, just a perfect orb perched atop a surprisingly detailed form. The figures had cloven feet and hands that had two opposable thumbs. They were even modestly dressed, with artfully carved draping folds and breeches covering forms that appeared to be androgynous. Was this how they actually looked? Del wondered. Or were these completely imaginary beings constructed by ancient crafters? Why so many? Del wondered aloud. And why were they all locked away down here?
Ha! If we only knew, sighed the Chadrafan. But someday we might. I do know one thing, though.
Piakau seized Del's hand and tugged him farther down the cavern. One of the statues had fallen, and Piakau had covered it with a blanket. It presented a curious image, as if the Chadrafan had been concerned that the statue might catch a chill.
This one toppled down for some reason. Look!
With a flourish, the Chadrafan pulled off the blanket. The simply carved orb that served the statue for a head had cracked open, revealing purple crystals. Clearly, the ancient denizens of Geosyn had used crystals to mimic glowing eyes. But there weren't simply two crystals inside the hollow skull. There were three. Two smaller ones and a much larger one. Del's gaze wandered down the body from the head. Piakau had taken tools to the statue, opening it up further, and now Del could see that it was not, as he had thought, carved of solid stone. It was as hollow as the head was, and inside the ceramic torso, arranged in all the places that one might expect to find organs in living beings, crystals of different sizes and shapes were positioned. These two had been carefully carved. Tentatively, Del reached out and touched one of the crystals. It was polished to perfect smoothness, and it was warm. Stunned, he looked over at a gleeful Piakau.
You see, don't you? These figures, they weren't pieces of art or architecture, the Chadrafan said, his high voice hushed with awe. These were machines.
Del sank back on his heels, wonder flowing through him.
But why create them just to put them down here? What was their purpose?
Maybe, Piakau said, if we could get one working, it could tell us.
Del looked back at the tumbled down droid. He supposed that was what it was, technically. A droid made of stone and crystal instead of metal, plastoid, and wiring.
Do you have the time to work on this?
Rarely, the little tinkerer replied, sighing. You're aware of how few of us know how to fix things when they break, especially since most of the things we get are already broken in some way. They have me working for hours on end. There's always something to keep me busy.
He turned from gazing raptly at the droid to peer conspiratorially at Del.
But if another talented technician just happened to show up, who could speed up those regular repairs by working with me as a team,
Maybe both of us could create some free time to work on these stone fellows down here.
Del was torn. He was here for a mission. To recover the lost information that had revitalized the Dreamers. And now there was a secondary one. Investigate Azen. He should stay as close to as many of the cell members as possible, so that he could overhear and observe anything that might be useful. But he'd never imagined stumbling across anything like this. Inhabitants of the galaxy over the millennia had utilized crystal energy as fuel. And the Death Star itself, of course, had been so awe-inspiringly deadly because it drew its energy from kyber crystals. But these crystals just seemed to sit there. He knew it would drive him crazy to walk away from this. Maybe there was a way to make it work out so he could do both. Pia Kao was a chatty little fellow. If Del could direct the Chatterfan's attention properly, Pia Kao might unwittingly reveal information he wasn't supposed to. And it wasn't as if he wouldn't be able to spend as much time as he needed working for the squad before heading down here. Inferno Squad was first. Always. But this could be second. Del made his decision. Maybe we could, he said, and smiled.
Chapter 19.
A few hours later, Dana, Kaeve, and Halia returned from a supply run with containers filled to the brim with a fruit that smelled like the very best kind of hot summer day. Just a whiff made Aiden, who had just returned moments before with the mentor, smile and her mouth water. Everyone crowded around and helped themselves, peeling the fruits deftly and popping the tangy sweet sections into their mouths.
"What is this called?"
Aiden asked, wiping her lips as the juice trickled down.
"No idea," said Sidori.
He snagged one of the largest of the bright yellow fruits and presented it to Sen with an awkward but somehow endearing little bow. She smiled and took it, laughing as she peeled it.
"We call it Dana Fruit because she loves it so much and it makes her happy," his mother said.
Aiden was surprised that the female Kagi had even acknowledged her, let alone answered her question so cheerfully. Apparently, Dana Fruit not only tasted wonderful, but also brought out the best in people. Then, without warning, Dana grabbed Pia Kao's hand and tugged playfully on it.
"Come on," she urged,
and led the Chatterfan out toward the front of the cavern. Aiden was completely confused. "What are they doing?" she asked the mentor as he came up beside her. He, like everyone else, was smiling.
"Why, they're dancing," he said.
And sure enough, the Twi'lek was stamping her feet on the ground, her graceful body moving in time to an unseen melody. Her leku danced too, undulating and twining. Sen was watching with great interest. "Studying what Dana is saying," Aiden thought. Then Sen looked startled as she had her own hand taken, and Sidori led her out onto what now had to be thought of as the dance floor. Pia Kao was thoroughly enjoying himself, chittering with laughter and moving as much as his frail body would permit. Aiden was confused. The Kagi couple smiled at each other. Aiden had never seen that before, and went to dance as well, holding each other's hands and swaying together. "I see that," Aiden said, annoyed. "But why?"
"Why do people dance?"
the mentor asked, and this time she realized he was teasing. She was still annoyed. "A Twi'lek," she said. "I know enough about slavery to know that Twi'lek female slaves are very popular with people who own slaves. Their masters make them dance for their own entertainment. So why would Dana want to dance?"
"Let's ask her,"
the mentor said, then called out,
"Dana, our newest member wants to know why you want to dance since you were forced to as a slave."
Aiden expected everything to come to an awkward, if not downright hostile, halt. Instead, the teal-skinned woman threw back her head and laughed.
"Because I can, child," she said. "Not because I have to. Because I want to. Because I can dance or sing or not do any of those things if I don't feel like it. I dance because I'm happy here with my family. I dance
Because I am free.
A roar of approval went up. This is what you're helping bring out, Aiden, the mentor continued.
Partying? Aiden said, only a little sarcastically.
Dana's simple joy in her movement was infectious. Piakow, though, still enjoying himself, had started to tire, and then Del had darted in, gently carrying the elderly Chadrafan to one of the flat-top rocks where he could recover from the exertion.
No, the mentor replied, choosing to take the question seriously. You're helping to bring freedom to the galaxy, so that one day, everywhere, people will be safe to express themselves, to enjoy without fear. That's what the rebels want in the end. That's all we want.
Del caught her eye and gave her a warm grin. Surprised, Aiden smiled back a bit awkwardly.
This makes you uncomfortable, the mentor observed.
Yes, it does, because what I'm seeing here now couldn't be more different from what happened here this morning. And it's hard for me to know that these hearts that are so full in this moment can turn so cruel.
It's certainly not the Empire, she said. And that might take some getting used to.
The next morning, if the term could even be used in a place that was constantly twilight, Inferno Squad was scattered as usual when they were sent for. Staven was waiting for them in the common cavern. Gideon was already there, sitting beside him, cleaning a blaster. He nodded at his brother in greeting, but largely ignored the rest of them.
I hope you're all ready to get to the real work, Staven said, because I've got jobs for all of you.
Finally, Aiden thought. She, Del, and Sen quickly expressed their willingness.
Gideon looked as though this was not news, which it probably wasn't.
He and Staven appeared to have bonded after Gideon's test flight. Staven waved them all to sit while he outlined the plan.
The Empire has begun mining operations on Aphidar, and we all know what that means.
Aiden knew a little about Aphidar. It was a largely undeveloped world with a relatively small population of humans and an indigenous amphibian species called the Tala'im. The Tala'im were sentient but primitive. Mining operations there couldn't be beneficial to them, but the human population would likely benefit from a new prosperity. And, of course, the Empire would have access to resources necessary to continue the war. The Empire was often faced with such difficult choices.
For a change, the worst thing about this situation is not the Empire, Staven said. It's the local government in the designated mining province that was chosen to work with them. Specifically the Ephor, Emok Akagarty. He's personally profited from the alliance at the expense of not only a beautiful world and the likely extinction of a sentient species, but the health of his own people. Or so rumor has it.
He smiled that edgy, cruel smile. In 3 days, we're going to pay him a visit.
We're going to use the JSEC ship that Aizen so nicely brought us when he kidnapped Aiden. Del, we need you and Piakow to spruce it up, make it look more imperial at first glance. We'll also allow you access to our databanks so you can figure out how to hack the security for the Ephor's residence.
Aiden forced herself not to smile. An Ephor was not a moth, but if Del could hack into a moth's home, he could definitely handle this.
We don't want to kill this man, necessarily. We want to ruin him, destroy him, show his people what kind of slime he really is. So here's how I think we can do that.
The more Aiden listened, the more she liked the plan. It could solve several of Inferno Squad's problems in one fell swoop. The downside was their schedule for eliminating Aizen just got bumped up. Way up. Del was delighted that he could work on the JSEC ship for both the Dreamer's mission and the one for Inferno Squad, and Sen's timing couldn't be more perfect.
You've got the list?
I do, Sen said, and handed him the data pad. It's all on there. Everything I could remember. Code names, alternate identities, the wording of his censures, everything. It should be of use.
I'm sure it will be of great use, thank you,
It's going to be tricky, but I think this'll work. I'm going to use these as keywords. I'm also going to see if I can find his logs in here.
Where's Pierre-Cal?
She asked, looking around. He's not been feeling well. Kind of worries me. She turned, surprised.
Worries you? He's a dreamer, Del. He's the enemy.
He is, Del said. And he's a smart, funny, imaginative fellow who didn't deserve what happened to him or his family. I can hold both in my head.
Just make sure it's in your head, not your heart, she said. Good luck.
Sen was heading back to the communal cavern for a bite to eat when she heard Sidori softly calling her name.
Sidori!
Hi,
she said, stammering a little. He'd caught her by surprise, and she rebuked herself. Then again, Sidori was quiet and lithe, moving with the grace of a big cat. The combination of his naturally gray skin and his dark clothing rendered him almost invisible in the dusk, but his pink eyes glowed brightly. He was calm, poised, and precise in everything, except when he was around her. He fell into step beside her. Back at Navint, her size had been completely irrelevant. Her companions were co-workers, whom she spoke with mostly in passing, and she spent almost all of her time in her darkroom watching vidscreens. Not only was her work detached emotionally, she was also physically removed from it. But here, and especially when she stood next to Sidori, she became acutely aware of her physical self. She barely came up to the middle of his chest and had to take almost 2 strides to his 1.
Sidori cleared his throat. I was just wondering if you might like to walk with me. It's pretty quiet tonight, and there's a place I go that I'd love to show you.
Sen was hungry, but everything was so tentative with Sidori that she was afraid of crushing him if she declined, and the team couldn't afford to close any doors right now. He noticed her hesitation.
We won't be long unless you decide you want to stay. I think you'll like it, but we can come right back if you want.
Warrior from birth Sidori might be, but there was a gentleness about him. She need fear no harm. Besides, she knew a thing or 10 about dropping an attacker who was twice her size. So she smiled.
I'm a bit hungry, but why don't we take something to eat with us?
His expression brightened.
A picnic? Yeah, let's do that.
He smiled down at her, then said,
Oh, by the way, do you know how to swim?
Sen looked at him askance. Would a slave have been taught this? Possibly.
I do, she said. Are we going swimming?
We'll be in water, and only if you want, though.
She was wearing one of Dana's outfits, a sleeveless tunic that fell to mid-thigh on the Twi'lek and mid-calf on her, and leggings she'd had to roll up twice. She could stand getting wet if the occasion warranted it.
We'll see what I think when I get there.
And let's pack our picnic and go.
He held out his hand. Sen looked at it for a moment. Del had to deal with the chatty chatter fan. Iden was forced to endure barely civil discourse from the Dreamer Leader. Gideon, lucky bastard, got to go flying.
And I have to pretend to be romantically interested in a teenage boy.
She smiled up at Sidori as she took his extended hand. They walked into the cavern, wrapped up some fruit and raw vegetables and 2 Preva eggs in some fabric, then went out into the constant twilight. She raised an eyebrow at the sight of a speeder bike awaiting them.
Ever been on one of these before?
Sidori asked. What was the right answer for a slave?
No,
she lied.
I'm very good at it. You'll be safe, I promise. Hop on and make sure you hang on tight.
Hoping she would not regret this, Sen climbed onto the bike behind the large, coggy youth, slipped her arms around his narrow waist, and held on. Mindful of Sen's supposed lack of experience, Sidori took it slowly, navigating through a maze of trees for about 15 minutes until they had reached a semi-grassy area. When the night phase of Geosyn arrived, the grass would die, to return at dawn. But for now, it was thick and lush, a pleasant contrast with the stone areas where the group made camp. Sidori powered down the bike and held out his hand to help her off. She allowed him to do so, looking around curiously. There were the usual lichen-covered rocks and starlight. The grass was a nice change, but it wasn't exactly special. She looked up at Sidori in inquiry. "Not here," he said, and pointed to what was a dark smudge against a sloping hill. There's a grotto in there. That's the place." Sen took a step in that direction, but Sidori hesitated. "Sen," he said, "do you trust me?" She tensed, but she was more curious than afraid.
"Why do you ask?"
"I want to surprise you," he said, his voice warm and eager. She glanced again toward the grotto, then said,
"Yes. What do you want me to do?"
"Take my hand and close your eyes," he said. "I'll make sure you don't stumble, I promise." Sen closed her eyes. She was still tense, and knew he could tell that, and when he touched her, his hand was gentle and respectful. He instructed her when to step forward and warned her when there was a stone or uneven ground in her path. He kept his promise. She did not have a single misstep. She could feel it when they entered the cave. The air was moist and cool. She heard a soft lapping sound, the promised water for possible swimming. It smelled like rich dirt and growing things, a comforting scent. Sidori put his hands on her shoulders, turning her to face in a certain direction, and then she heard him moving about the area. There were a few soft splashes, and then he said, "Okay, open your eyes." She did so, and gasped. Magnificent indigo crystals jutted up from the floor of the cavern, providing light enough to see, but little more. Sidori had removed his tunic and stood waist-high in the water. He kept very still, hardly even breathing. In his hands he held a large bowl that was carved from another type of crystal, also purple, but lighter, more magenta in color.
"Sidori, this place is beautiful," Sen said honestly.
She found herself smiling. "It is," he agreed. "But this isn't why I brought you here." He lifted one hand from the crystal bowl with a flourish, then dipped it into the water with a sweeping motion. Soft blue light appeared, trailing after his fingers like liquid blue flame. It was nothing unique in the galaxy. The scientific phenomenon of bioluminescence, the emission of light by a living organism, appeared on multiple worlds. But here, in the cool, slightly damp darkness, it looked ethereal and mystical. Sidori beamed at her pleased reaction. "You can stay there if you want," he said.
"Oh, no," Sen said. "I'm coming in."
She kicked off her boots, but before she stepped into the pool, she paused and looked at him.
"But I'm curious. Why have you brought me here now?"
His expression turned pensive. "We'll be going on our first mission together very soon. Anything can happen. I just wanted to share this place with you before... Well, just in case something goes wrong." Sen realized that not even special forces like Inferno Squad lived on the edges as much as the Dreamers did. They put their lives on the line with every mission, of course, but they didn't wear bombs strapped to their bodies. No wonder they danced and laughed and drank and lived while they could. She stepped forward into the pool. With each splash of her feet, there was a blue rippling reaction as the tiny living organisms in the water responded to movement. The bottom of the pool leveled out quickly, and she stood facing Sidori as he held the bowl. He set the bowl down into the water. A sudden flare of blue around it continued as the crystal bowl floated, bobbing gently. Sidori picked up a small stick about as long as his hand that had been resting inside the bowl. "This bowl came from my homeworld of Quartzsite. It was one of the few things we took with us when we left. As long as there have been Coggies, it's said, there have been these bowls. And as long as the bowls sing, the Coggies will continue." Very gently, he struck the bowl's rim with a stick. A haunting, bell-like tone issued forth. Another blue flare blossomed in the pool, fading with the sound.
"The vibrations," Sen said, her voice soft with wonder. They can feel the vibrations. His pink-hued eyes glowed like the tiny sea creatures.
Magical, isn't it?
It was not magic. But at the same time, it was.
Yes,
Sen said. And she stood there in the cool water, shivering but unwilling to leave, not thinking about the past or the future, but fully here in this place, with this beautiful boy, listening to the haunting tones of the singing crystal bowl, while Sidori played the music of ancient stones, and the glowing blue creatures danced to the sound.
The mentor offered encouragement during Aiden's repeated practice sessions with him at the amphitheater. She was improving. She could tell. But the mentor was constantly trying to make her even better.
Don't shout, he would tell her. You don't have to. Or, don't let your eyes dart around. You want to look full into the holorecorder. You can't possibly tell me you've never done that before.
Aiden felt a stab of pain as she recalled her mother's message. It reminded her that she needed to finish this mission and get home, and tell her increasingly frail mother that her daughter had never once swayed from her loyalty to the Empire. She would need to deliver a few speeches on behalf of the Dreamers, but she hoped fiercely that it would be no more than that. She also hoped, probably futilely, that her mother might not be informed of the speeches. It had been hard enough on Zihei to see the footage shown at Aiden's court-martial. If she saw this...
Of course I've done this before, Aiden said. She could not allow herself any distraction from the task at hand. But this feels different.
You're getting better. I know, I'm pushing you.
Don't apologize, Aiden said. I don't want to be better. I want to excel. Steven brought me here for this, and I want to prove myself to him.
You and I have so much in common. I suppose I simply assumed you'd take to this as easily as I did. I know it's not something you're used to, but it's hard to overestimate how helpful to our cause it will be. You'll be saving lives, too. It's always better to reason with people than to kill them.
Some people just can't be reasoned with, Aiden said. She went to sit beside him on the ground. He seemed to be in a reflective frame of mind. Maybe she could use that.
She grasped a nearby stick and began scratching lines in the hard-baked dirt.
And that knowledge grieves me, he said. But it doesn't mean I can deny it.
You're an odd partisan, she said.
I know.
Steven and I, disagree on how to go about many things. But we both agree that the Empire must be defeated.
Scritch, scritch.
Keeping her eyes on the lines emerging from the tip of her stick, Aiden said, "What do you mean we have so much in common?" He was quiet for a moment, then spoke.
"I came from a famous family," he said. "During the Clone Wars, I was confused, seeking answers with all the fire and folly of a young teenager."
He smiled a little. At the gesture, Aiden glanced at him. She could see the boy inside him still. If the years had not been kind to his spirit, they had been gentle with him physically.
I ended up with the wrong sort of rebels, and then what I thought were the right sort.
Saw and Steela, Aiden said.
Saw and Steela,
he confirmed.
But we lost Steela, and Saw forged his own path with the partisans. My goddaughter joined him. I didn't.
Not then.
It seemed like, over the course of my life, I've been on every side imaginable. The Confederacy, the Republic, the Empire, the Alliance, and then back to the Partisans. I worked with Saw again for a time. Not physically. But we were in communication. Then came Jedha. And now Saw's gone. I was angry. And sorrowful. And I want this war over.
You don't approve of the level of partisan violence. It was a statement, not a question.
No, he said. Never have. But I do approve of Saw and Steela's passion. And I don't want to overthrow Staven. I just wish he would listen.
An idea was forming, hot and exciting, inside Iden's mind. This could be the way to complete this mission. She had already observed that some of the partisans did what they did because they felt there was no choice. Others seemed to thrive on the violence, the slaughter. She understood that. She'd never felt as alive as when she was firing on the rebels, blowing them out of the sky. Every member of Inferno Squad was a soldier. They'd all been involved with combat, taken lives. Some in ways more brutal than others. This was the answer. Each team member was already focused on one or more of the partisans. Staven was not leading a unified band. Names easily came to mind of those who were either as unshakably loyal or as bloodthirsty as he. Azen, the adult Coggies, Nadrine. Then there was Piakow and Dana, who did what they did out of duty, not delight. She paused and looked at what she absentmindedly sketched in the dirt. Stick figures with blasters. Some were scowling. Some were smiling. Divide and conquer. An ancient strategy in warfare, perhaps as old as warfare itself.